The ARA acknowledges the traditional owners of the land where we have recorded this podcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present, and recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as Australia's first traders, who utilise a sophisticated network of trading paths that have facilitated the exchange of goods, knowledge, and culture for millennia.
Hi, I'm Paul Zara, CEO of the Australian Retailers Association, and welcome to Season 6 of the Retail Therapy Podcast, proudly brought to you by American Express. In today's retail landscape, it's vital to understand the nuance and intricacies of diversity, equality, and inclusion. It isn't just a buzzword, but a powerful force driving innovation and change across the sector. In each episode this season, we'll be focusing on the specific branch of the D&I tree, speaking to pioneers and leaders in their respective fields. Joining me for some retail therapy in our Diversity, Equality, Inclusion series is Natalie Phillips-Mason, founder of Inclusive Change and an advocate for neuroinclusivity in the workplace. Inclusive Change is a change management consultancy that works with leaders and teams to recognise and harness the power of thought diversity, inclusion and belonging. Natalie works with many neurodivergent professionals, and we're really pleased to hear from her today on this important topic. Natalie, welcome.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Now, Natalie, you work with businesses and corporations to steer them towards better outcomes for diversity and inclusion. Can you walk us through how you approach this?
Sure. So I focus on neuroinclusion, and that is a topic that's become probably a little bit more important, certainly post-COVID, but it is really about appreciating and recognising that there are a lot of different brains and people have brains that are unique, and each of these brain types are actually as valuable as each other. So the way that our brains are wired is very unique to individuals, and neuroinclusion really recognises that there are a whole lot of different brain types out there and none is one more valuable than another. So the neuroinclusive space, particularly from a workplace perspective, has become one of the, I guess, newer pillars within the DEI space, and really is focused on non-visible differences and the diversity that we all have in the workplace when it comes to non-visible differences. So the way we think, the way we communicate, the way our brain is wired and the way that it processes information is different. And it's an area that I think has become much more in the mainstream. We've got a lot more people who are finding out quite late in their lives that they have a brain that is wired a little differently. And, I mean, it might be worth kind of mentioning a couple of common terms that we hear about. And the first is neurodiversity. Mm. And neurodiversity was actually coined by an Australian sociologist in the late 90s. And really, that is a term that describes the natural variation of brain wiring that exists within the human population. So, in fact, neurodiversity refers to everyone. Neurodivergence, or neurodivergent brain types, was coined by an autistic advocate in the early 2000s. And that term really describes a group of people whose brains are wired differently from the neuro majority. So we might hear the word neurotypical, and that really describes people whose brains are wired a little bit more similarly to each other. So, you know, those people tend to interact with their environment more similarly to each other, perhaps engage in primary communication methods more similarly to each other. And then we have a neurodivergent population whose brains are wired in a slightly different way. And so the neurodivergence umbrella, if you like, it covers a whole lot of different neurodivergent conditions.
Yeah, so
autism
you,
would
so I was
be one
say,
example.
Because I think I hear often that neurodiversity or neurodivergence is a politically correct way to describe autism. Is that the way you see it?
So autism is one neurotype, and I think autism is the neurotype that's probably been most researched from a medical perspective. There are so many more neurotypes that are coming to the fore, and also even our understanding of autism is changed dramatically. So, you know, women are becoming diagnosed with autism or discovering their autistic brain much later in life because the medical model tended to really base the assessment on how boys presented, autistic boys presented. We have ADHD, so attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There are a lot of disses, by the way, in this language, and it's not great, and it's probably led to a lot of stereotypical understanding about neurodivergence. But for now, it's still called ADHD. So ADHD is another neurotype. Again, stereotypically understood as the naughty boy in the classroom who couldn't sit still. We know that that's not the case anymore. Tourette's syndrome and other tic conditions, dyspraxia, dyslexia, of which 10% of the global population are dyslexic.
Yes.
So what we understood as being, I guess, a fringe minority is starting to change quite dramatically. And so the way we are talking about neurodivergence has changed and is changing. And that relates not only to the workplace, but it also relates a lot to the customer, which I think we'll probably end up talking a little bit more about.
We certainly will. Now, when you talk about neurodivergence, it seems like a very wide group, like in fact much wider. And you spoke just about many women finding, and I'm sure it happens for men as well, that find that they're autistic much later in life. What would that experience like, do you think, be for an individual?
So based on conversations that have been shared with me, I think that there is an element of relief for many people who understand much more about how they tick. There is a lot of trauma as well that comes with that for individuals who all of a sudden need to unpack what that means for them, unpack how they process information, perhaps how they learn, what they might have done differently had they known earlier. It's really a very different experience for different individuals. I think why this is also so important, though, from a DEI perspective, is that it is so intersectional. So when we talk about gender, when we talk about First Nations and other minority, you know, communities, we're talking about the human brain. So it is something that is almost an anchor point across all DEI pillars. And for that reason, I think there's also a really important conversation around just how many people, fall under that neurodivergent identification.
Now, neurodiversity has risen to greater prominence in recent years. Can you tell our listeners how companies are identifying and working with neurodiverse people?
So I think the first point to say is that organisations and workforces are neurodiverse, as to the definitions we've just discussed. In terms of identifying neurodivergence and supporting neurodivergent employees, it's a really interesting space because the fact is that not everyone will seek a diagnosis. And so historically, accommodations in the workplace and adjustments have worked with a concept of neurodivergence that A, people know that they are neurodivergent, and many people don't necessarily recognise that they are. B, if people have sought a diagnosis, then that is a very personal piece of information to share with your employer. And historically, this has not been an area where employers are educated in terms of what the modern workforce looks like in this space. And so in many cases, employees may choose not to share that information or disclose that information in the workplace. So the fact of the matter is at the moment is that we know around 1 in 5 people identify as neurodivergent, right? Around 20% of the global population.
So more common than we may think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's no longer a fringe minority. And that's why I think this is a really important conversation. Now, the other thing about that 20% statistic is that doesn't necessarily account for people in late stages of life who are discovering their neurodivergence. It doesn't necessarily relate to all the people who may self-identify,
right,
but not have a diagnosis and may never seek a diagnosis. So if we run with the conservative, it's 1 in 5. And that means that there are 1 in 5 people that may walk into a store that are neurodivergent. So we may not know who they are.
Yes.
Employers may never know who they are. But I don't think you need to know who they are, because I think the assumption is that if a fifth of your workforce are neurodivergent, then it makes sense to proactively design your processes and your ecosystem to ensure that everyone has the right to contribute Absolutely. Within the workplace.
So if somebody was listening today that may think they're neurodivergent, what would your advice be to them?
So I would love to see people self-advocate more, but that is something that I can't really advise because it's not a risk that I hold. Mm. What I have seen more in my interviews with many different neurodivergent people of all different ages, all different professions and backgrounds, is that our younger generations are certainly self-identifying and self-advocating a lot louder than previous generations. And
what do you think that is? Is there less taboo today, more information maybe?
I think there's more information, but I also think it's a reflection of the way this generation thinks and the way this generation wants to have a greater voice in you know, areas like sustainability, areas like diversity and equity and inclusion. So I think it's behaviour we're seeing more and more in younger generations, and that means they are the generations that are going to be looking for work in retail, in other sectors. And so it really makes sense for organisations to understand and to educate themselves in Absolutely. This space.
So an individual would start with their GP, I'm assuming, to get that diagnosis first.
If they choose to. Yep. If they choose to. You know, again, I think there's many people that choose not to seek a diagnosis, and there are quite a few barriers to that. I mean, we know it's an expensive process. We know that it takes time, and I don't think it's necessarily a given. I think people will choose whether or not they need to seek a diagnosis on the basis of whether they feel it's something that they need. But I don't think it's a given. I certainly don't think it's a given.
That's really good information. Now, I'm interested to hear a little bit about your personal background. What enticed you to pursue this career and become a prominent neuroinclusivity campaigner?
Campaign is a really interesting word. I guess I've never really thought of myself as a campaigner. I've always thought of myself as an ally, but I guess it's probably quite an accurate description. Three parts to why I've ended up in this space. The first is that I am part of a mixed neurotype family, or what I now understand is a mixed neurotype family. So we have people in our family who identify as neurodivergent. Some have sought diagnoses, some haven't. I've supported those people through that diagnostic process. And as part of that experience, I've just had a huge education around where some of the misinformation is, where the stereotypes are from, you know, 40, 50 years ago that are just no longer accurate because of what we know now of neurodivergence. We have people in our family who are the same neurotype who are completely different in terms of how they see the world. So that's one part. The second part is I have a career in change management, and that my job is to help embed change programs into organisations that are asking their people to behave differently and adopt new ways of working. And so that's been a very human-centric career for me. And so I know that people don't learn and communicate and process information in the same way.
Yeah.
And then the third part is I've had roles in retail. So I, you know, had exposure to the retail sector and probably started identifying a lot of opportunities in that space with particular emphasis on neurodivergence and what that means for the customer experience. So,
absolutely. It's interesting because retail is always looking for new customer bases, and there's no doubt those that embrace diversity, equality, inclusion have got a much broader reach. And this is one of those, I'm hoping from this podcast that retailers listening may see this as a massive opportunity. I want to ask you a little bit about, given your history, what role do you think the training and awareness play in ensuring that customer service staff are equipped to assist neurodivergent shoppers because they have different needs and provide a positive shopping experience for them?
Yeah, it's absolutely at the heart of it. I just don't think you can really implement initiatives without understanding the customer group that you're trying to the needs that you're trying to meet, and you're spot on. The customer needs are varied absolutely vary. Yes. But what we do know is that initiatives like Quiet Hour are proving to be and have proven to be really successful to at least start to open the door to the concept that there are sensory-friendly, you know, periods within stores that make a difference to neurodivergent shoppers. And actually, they make a difference to neurotypical shoppers too. And that's what the data is telling us. And in fact, we've just commissioned a piece of market research in this space, and 7 out of 10 neurodivergent customers that we surveyed said that this is still something that they think is providing a valuable, a valuable initiative within retail. So education is absolutely at the crux of it. I think retailers, and I'm hoping, you know, this will spark more conversation around modern education around neurodivergence and the fact that there is no one formula for this, but there are certainly opportunities within retail that might go even beyond Quiet Hour. So again, our market research is telling us that staff who are more educated in this space will make a difference in store.
Yes.
Why people choose to shop in store and versus online is a really important aspect of this too. I'm not sure how much retailers understand of the sensory system and how it works. It's not necessarily just about lights and sound, although that's two very important parts. But, you know, you have sensory-friendly spaces for people to self-regulate. You have lots of opportunities in product range. You know, I know Kmart has recently looked at the sensory-sensitive clothing. So what does it mean to not have scratchy labels, as an example?
Yes.
You're talking about brands that are more often, and actually in the educational space, if you look at Lego, if you look at Barbie, if you look at toys, there are more characters that are neurodivergent. You know, so this is something that is reflective of our communities. And so I think there's a massive amount of education that retailers could engage with.
Yes.
And certainly the research that we've just done is telling us that, you know, we surveyed 600 odd customers, of which 50% were neurodivergent, self-identified. And beyond a doubt, the choice drivers and why customers would choose one brand over another and what entices them to go into store as opposed to shopping online. There is some really important data in that space, and I think it's really important, particularly when you're looking at loyalty programs like subscription programs or loyalty programs that are enticing people into store to do their shopping. There are some barriers that could be removed, and there are customer experiences that just could be a lot safer and accessible for a wider range of customers.
You raised some good points there. Now, you mentioned also around employers that need to understand neurodiversity a little bit further. Now, part of that would be around collecting data at that point of application or through hiring decisions.
Yeah.
And some retailers, or many companies actually, not just retailers, are concerned about collecting information that may be seen as being privacy-related issues.
Yes.
Are there any retail companies that have implemented successful neurodiversity hiring programs? And maybe just if you can let us know what outcomes they've observed.
So organisations that have engaged in neurodivergent hiring programs have typically and historically wanted to, I guess, address the fact that particularly in the autistic community, there is a much higher rate of underemployment and unemployment. And that's been a pretty disturbing statistic for a while. I guess when we come back to the concept of hidden differences, hidden disabilities, if we assume that 20% of the population are neurodivergent, that means that organisations already have 20% of their workforces that are neurodivergent. So I tend to look at it and talk about understanding your own backyard. Mm. I think that if you don't have that educational scaffolding, then organisations that are looking to hire in neurodivergent people might be missing the point around what they've already got in their own backyard. Right. So there are certainly organisations that have focused on hiring in, and I think that's a really important part of the landscape. But I think a really important part of the conversation is knowing who you've already got and how to support them.
And do you encourage businesses to do that, to actually, through, I'm assuming, via survey, to understand what people's differences are. This could be one of them.
I think it's a really tricky space at the moment because of privacy. I also think organisations are a little bit nervous about asking. But I think to your earlier point around recruitment and recruitment practices, you know, I don't think there's anyone stopping to ask a candidate whether they have any requirements that they might have through the recruitment process. I think the other thing, you know, that you can do is offer alternatives and be flexible about how people apply for roles.
Yeah.
So can I submit a video if I'm more comfortable telling you a bit about myself?
Mm.
So flexibility in how we invite candidates in, where we post jobs to begin with, where, you know, are we looking at job boards that are appealing to a diverse range of candidates for a whole lot of reasons. Those are things that I think you can do. And at least it invites someone to ask for what they need. Now, again, we've got to remember that, you know, there are a lot of people who have been burnt in the past through, you know, through maybe disclosing or sharing information that might not have gone the way that they wanted it to. So it's still quite a sensitive topic. But I think there are certainly ways that we can encourage a dialogue, at least through the recruitment process, that at least invites people to ask for what they need through those processes.
Do you think that there are stereotypical skill sets that are aligned to certain neurodivergent groups?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. So typically it's been in the data, finance, technology space where, you know, autistic people have shown a greater degree of skill. But I think that's one of the stereotypes and the myths that, you know, I certainly try and bust. I know more than dozens of neurodivergent creatives, highly creative people who just see, can visualize things in an incredible way, can bring such creativity to the job that they do. And so when you think about merchandising or layout or branding and advertising, these are people who have a huge amount of skill in that space.
Yes.
But I absolutely do think that this is part of the stereotype. There is also this concept of neurodivergent people and superpowers. And I think we've just got to be really careful about expecting people with, you know, different brain wiring to be superheroes.
Yes.
You know, I think this is about equity and it's about inclusion and it's just making sure that people feel like they belong, not only in the workplace, but also they're comfortable to go shopping, they're comfortable in schools, they're comfortable in society. So, you know, I think this is about talent and it's about sourcing talent in the right way for the right roles.
What challenges might a neurodivergent individual have facing in a customer-facing role, do you think, in a retail store?
Some may have challenges and some may not. So I think, you know, again, I've met, you know, neurodivergent people who love customer service, who may have a special interest in technology as an example and love being able to share that knowledge with a customer and really help them choose the right product as an example. There are other people who, you know, customer service isn't their thing. So that might not be the right role, but there are plenty of other roles out there and plenty of people who can add value within the retail space, either front of house, back of house, or in head office.
Well, maybe the question, ask you this question differently. What support do you think a retailer would provide somebody that if they've identified they've got a neurodivergent staff member?
Yep.
How do they support them to get the best out of them?
So the first question is to ask your neurodivergent employee. That's absolutely the first question. But then there are other things that might really be useful, like having sensory-friendly spaces where people can just regulate. You know, if it's been a really busy day or if they need a 10-minute break, give them a bit of space to just regulate themselves. The break times, flexibility in rostering in terms of people being able to choose the shifts that work best for when they're most productive, I think is another really interesting point. That might not work for every retailer, obviously, but certainly there's a lot of merit in people being able to choose when they work productively, and I think retail is no different. So there's a couple of examples.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think there's a responsibility too to educate their workforce? And when you think about management skills, we don't really talk about managing difference. This is a really good example where, you know, easily people are put into a stereotypical box and actually and managers don't understand how to necessarily manage those individuals.
Yeah.
I guess, how do you go about reducing the stigma associated with a potential stigma with a neurodivergent person?
Yeah.
So and support a young manager in working through that individual?
Yeah. I think it's a really important part of the education. So the work that I'm doing with my clients starts with education. It starts with really unpacking what we know about neurodivergence today. And it's as much about what we know about neurodivergence and what it is, as well as what it isn't.
Mm.
So to the earlier comment I made about a lot of the negativity and the dis language,
yes,
it's actually breaking all of that down and it's turning it on its head and it's changing the narrative so that people, leaders, understand where behaviours are coming from. They understand if someone approaches them and says, I really need a 10-minute break, it's coming from somewhere real. It's coming from, and that is the dialogue that I hope more people leaders are having with their employees so that we're not dismissive when people are asking for what, you know, what might seem an unreasonable adjustment.
Yes.
These are adjustments that are actually critical so that people can go about doing their jobs and doing them well.
Let's talk a little bit about neurodivergent customers. So do you think, how does a neurodivergent customer see themselves in the advertising of a retailer?
I don't know that they do, actually, because, you know, I think we are still unpacking so much about what neurodivergence is and what it isn't that I don't know there's a whole lot of representation there at the moment. And I think until we get a better view of the customer, and it might be something that never plays out in advertising, you know, because hopefully we just normalize difference and we don't need to be creating campaigns that are targeting a specific neurodivergent community. I think that what I'd love to be able to see is that we're making adjustments within the store experience predominantly where people feel more comfortable to come and shop.
Yeah.
Perhaps we've got product ranges that are addressing the needs of neurodivergent customers and neurotypical customers. I don't think it's a one or either. So I don't know. I think we're a long way off from seeing the advertising space here. I think there's certainly more opportunity to create some awareness campaigns around things like quiet hour, sensory friendly spaces. You know, there are the MCG, you've got Marvel, you've got lots of entertainment precincts that are now recognising the role of a sensory friendly space. Perhaps as more retailers pick up on quiet hour, Walmart's just announced last month that they're running a quiet hour on a Saturday, particularly around back to school. So there's a lot of things that we could be doing in this country, I think, that, and I think maybe that's where the advertising and the brand piece will come into it, as opposed to actually bringing, you know, neurodivergent characters into the fray.
Now, part of this podcast is to actually also bring neurodiversity, because it's fairly new diversity pillar when you think about it, to the fore, and we want it to gain recognition in the retail sector. So my final question to you, Natalie, is what would you like to see from a retail perspective? What would be your most important hit list for retailers to take notice of?
I think first and foremost, look at the data, because we've got some pretty good data sets now around not only initiatives like Quiet Hour, but market research that is really creating a story and a narrative around this hidden customer segment and what they're looking for. But I also think we can't underestimate what neurotypical customers want. And, you know, so there's some data showing us some really interesting potential trends and choice drivers. I would love to see more retailers engage in that data and actually start to have an elevated conversation around this as something that is genuinely part of customer experience and brand, you know, brand value. I'd love to see more retailers start to test and learn some neuro-inclusive practices, not just within store, but also within their workplaces. And I think the really nice link about starting with the customer for retailers is it's going to teach them about their own workforce. So you can't quite lose. But what I also think you need to do is make sure that those initiatives are being led by people with lived experience. Yes. And people who can drive the conversation, because that's how they live and that's the way they see the world. And there's plenty of amazing lived experience voices out there. So that's what I'd love to see.
Wonderful. Final question to you. Mm-hmm. Is where do retailers go to find out more?
In terms of market research, they can contact me at Inclusive Change, which is www.inc-change.com. I think there are plenty of lived experience voices as well on social media. And I think companies like Aspect, so Autism Spectrum Australia, are doing a lot of amazing work with retailers. People like Lisa Cox, who are disability advocates who are looking at both physical and non-visible differences, does amazing work in this space, particularly in advertising and marketing and brand representation. And, yeah, that's probably where I'd start. And, yeah, hopefully we will start to shift the dial a bit.
Natalie, keep up the great work. Appreciate you joining us for some retail therapy. All the best for the future.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us in the Amex Lounge for some retail therapy. Make sure you subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify. We can be found wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts. For more information about the work we do at the Australian Retailers Association, head to our website, retail.org.au. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, wherever you love to connect. All the links can be found in the show notes.